Hi, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Nick Gillespie. Hello, Nick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Matt Welch.
Hi, Andrew.
And Catherine Mangu Ward.
Howdy.
So last week, there was an attack in Virginia. A shooter opened fire on a number of people associated with Congress, including Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana, who is still in serious condition. And it's opened up all sorts of dialogues on the national level about what's happening. The one that I'm most fascinated by that I've heard multiple times in the last week is basically... Well, this is what we get in Trump's America. People are going to feel more comfortable being violent with a reckless president like Trump in office. Matt Welch, do you feel more at ease releasing violent impulses with Trump in office?
I mean, imagine it's such a weird connective tissue of saying it has something to do with Trump's America, the fact that a bunch of Republicans got shot up by someone who clearly attempted to assassinate as many as possible, but thankfully doesn't appear to have any familiarity with a gun, or at least any effectiveness with it. I think that there's a couple of almost but not quite overlapping ideas here. One is, you know, do we blame rhetoric for political rhetoric and hyperbole for violence, for individual acts of violence? And I think unequivocally the answer to that is no. You blame it on the individual who perpetrated it, and you give that person agency. A separate question, which is interesting, and it kind of gets more to the spirit of what you're talking about, is... do we have a kind of a growing polarization? Does the apocalyptic rhetoric, which is very strong and I believe anecdotally and is growing, is that a thing worth being concerned about to some degree? And I would say, yeah, it's worth looking at and being concerned about. It's just important not to draw a direct line between that and individual acts of violence. And people are incredibly hypocritical when they do it. When it's the target is a Democrat, they have no problem at all spending a lot of time immediately blaming all Republicans for not, and all conservatives for not, you know, more forcefully going after the climate of violence in the right wing. When it's Republicans who are the victims, then literally you get into a situation that we saw over the weekend of people saying, yeah, you know what, Steve Scalise, he's, you know, he's a bigoted homophobe. It's important to keep that in mind, which is George Takei and Joy Reid from MSNBC were floating that recently. So it's painful to watch all of that happen. I think that in terms of rhetoric, the thing that I think is worrying is that you have a growing sense of collectivism on both sides. And I wrote about a piece about this at the end of the election. You calling a huge swath of voters deplorables, calling a judge, you know, bad just because he's Mexican, or unable to be partial in his rendering of justice just because he's a Mexican. These are worrying rhetorical trends. They are not the cause of violence. They are something that we should condemn on their own, as we should condemn violence on its own.
And you raise a good point that there is kind of a double standard that goes on depending on who the attacker is and who the victim is. In this case, the attacker was a fairly big, or I don't know the extent to which he supported Bernie Sanders, but he was a Bernie Sanders supporter.
He's a volunteer on his campaign.
Yeah, and he'd written a number of articles for, I think, editorial letters for his local newspaper. Catherine, does the fact that he had a particular political ideology, does that have significance in this situation, or is he just a nut job that happened to be of the left?
So I pretty much always go with the latter, just a nut job that happened to be insert quality X here. I think this goes, of course, for Islamic terrorists as well as Bernie Sanders terrorists. And the piece of this that I find interesting is the jump to conspiracy theory, which is inevitable at moments like this. But the version of it that I saw was very interesting. So I grew up in Alexandria, where the shooting was. If I had ever participated in a single sporting event in my life, it almost certainly would have been at that field, though I didn't. So I can't say for sure. But I saw a whole bunch of coverage very early on, right after the shooting, of people saying, well, how did he know they would be there? there's a leak. Someone told him. And it, you know, you do like a Google News search for congressional baseball practice and like photos of that field from them practicing over the last 5 years show up. So, you know, just this notion that somehow it's all part of a greater plan. It's all part of a greater scheme. It's all part of a political movement or ideology. It's not. It isn't. It never is. And even if that was one thing in the cocktail of motivations of this, unfortunately, clearly unstable human, it is not fair to blame Bernie Sanders for that shooting any more than it's fair to blame Islam for San Bernardino. It's just not, you know, and I think that's the place where it actually gets controversial. I think people really, really, really want to blame Islam for San Bernardino. They really want to blame you know, certain types of unstable people who are attracted to ideologies that are otherwise politically problematic. They want to connect those things. And I think the connection is just as tenuous in those cases as it is in the case of the Bernie shooter.
I agree with you. And I think that it's a weird kind of schadenfreude that's happening as well, where I saw a lot of people that almost seemed gleeful on Twitter to find out that he was a left-wing guy.
But, oh, totally. There was like genuine joy that greeted that news. And that screwed up.
Yeah. 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 Nick, one of the headlines that I really liked from this last week commenting on this was from the America's Journal of Record, The Onion. And it said that the Virginia shooter somehow proves what every single American has been saying all along. And you know, mostly about gun control. Do you think this confirms everything you believe?
Oh, yeah. But since I'm a nihilist, you know, it really doesn't change anything for me. So the thing that I found odd with building off of some of the things that Matt and Catherine said is the way, you know, these events never happen in isolated fashion, and they're always part of a news flow, and people are working their agenda beyond this. And one of the things that I saw that is worrying for a lot of reasons, we write, but is the idea that even among people who would be like, look, the shooter is responsible, not the rhetoric, you know, not this amorphous, vague cloud of nasty rhetoric, which may or may not be worse than 5 years ago or 25 or 50 years ago. But we need to change the rhetoric. And I've seen a lot of people say that, you know, because there are crazy people out there who may misinterpret what we're saying, we have to say things differently. We have to tamp down actually negative appraisals of things. We need to be much more kind of dealing in a more positive way when we disagree with people. And there's always that gesture to kind of start chipping away at the edges of people speaking freely. I actually think, you know, I think things like this, shootings like this, they're not proceeding from any kind of clear, understandable reaction to what is being said or even what's being done in the country. They are the work of people who are unbalanced. I think, you know, with very few exceptions, they're responsible for these actions unless they're actually proven insane. But to me, one of the most worrying things to come out of this is the idea that, okay, well, those of us who have strong criticisms of the status quo, strong criticisms of people like Steve Scalise, whose legislative agenda I find generally off, but also of people like Bernie Sanders. Like, so now we're supposed to kind of tuck in our horns a little bit because God knows that, you know, there's always somebody out there who can take things the wrong way and go, you know, go shoot up a place. It's similar to, you know, back in the day, and I'm thinking in the 80s, I guess, when John Lennon was shot, you know, Mark David Chapman was carrying a copy or had a copy of Catcher in the Rye with him. It would be as if saying, you know, J.D. Salinger really should have softened up that book because there's a potential Mark David Chapman out there. This argument got much more explicit later in the 80s with the Satanic Verses when Salman Rushdie was attacked by people on the left and the right for writing such an incendiary book, as if, you know, saying that you're upset with something and that the political status quo or the cultural status quo or something has to change is ever, you know, responsible for violence that is ultimately not even connected to what a text or what a speech or what a speech act is about.
That all said, I think that there's some, as a personal matter, meaning as a matter for Matt, I think there is value that I don't inflict on others to avoid that kind of collective demonization and apocalyptic nonsenses. I don't think, from my point of view, that I think that's a shortcut around finding the truth of things and also of being an effective communicator by my own lights. And I think that's fine to pursue on your own as your own value. But Nick is absolutely right to do it as a response to tragedy. That's always being asked of people who are on the opposite side of the ideological spectrum of the person doing the asking. And that's just how it always happens. And it's not a very seemly process.
No, and it's, you know, to bring it back to one of the great examples of that, the way in which you still see people talking about how John F. Kennedy, when he went to Dallas in November of 1963, was going into a world of, you know, filled with right-wing hate, a city filled with right-wing hate. And somehow the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald, who was, you know, by his own admission, a Marxist-Leninist, a member of Fair Play for Cuba, a defector to the Soviet Union, who hated Kennedy for his anti-communism, somehow it was that climate of right-wing violence that pulled the trigger of Lee Harvey Oswald's rifle from the book depository. And it just gets weird because people don't want to kind of admit that there are actors who are unstable and who change history or try to change history.
It's genuinely distressing, sorry, Catherine, to see people unwilling to even look at what they wrote themselves about Jared Loughner in 2011 before they opened their mouths about this in 2017. You should be looking for, as much as possible, a consistent approach to questions like that, even if they're not perfect anecdotes of one or analogs of one another.
And Matt's quite right. I mean, this is, you know, in some ways it's just libertarianism 101, but there is a huge distinction between saying I should not be a person who adds to the sum total of, you know, extreme unfounded political rhetoric in the world, and we should make extreme unfounded political rhetoric illegal or discourage it using political tools. Like, that's it. There's an important distinction there, and that distinction just seems to disappear completely in the face of in the face of violence, but in particular, in the face of violence done by the people on the other side of the debate from me.
Well, you know, to continue this and bring it into some stories we covered at Reason, Matt posted a great documentary, short news item from Vice, featuring Michael Moynihan, former Reason staffer, who's now at Vice. But he went to Evergreen State College, where a left-wing, you know, self-identified progressive professor is under attack for questioning the sagacity of a no whites allowed day at that school. And you see in that when you hear the students talking, and even more chillingly, the college president, who is, you know, giving Neville Chamberlain a run for his money, or Quisling. I mean, just in like having an overcooked piece of fettuccine for a backbone. But you see this weird slippage of language that might be violent. I don't know exactly what that would mean, but, you know, where there are threats in it, or saying like, we really want to get rid of these people, you know, eliminationist rhetoric or something, slides over into action. And I'm very nervous because I've seen things like where, you know, people saying like, oh, if you say like, I want to take out Trump, you know, or I want to take out the Republicans in 2018, you're sanctioning murder, or vice versa. These can go in all sorts of ways. And it's a weird slippage between the idea that words are words and actions are actions, and clearly words and actions have, you know, connective tissue. But I think we're in a country now where people go back and forth between thoughts and deeds in a way that it only serves to kind of try and limit what we are allowed to think, much less what we are allowed to do, in a way that's genuinely repressive. And I think it's worth standing up, not for being a jerk necessarily, but for really insisting on a clear demarcation between words, rhetoric, actions, deeds, and responsibility. Because it's, you know, it's just not good to be constantly conflating somebody's statement about something or disagreement about something with violence, which I think we see more and more of.
I also want to stand up for standing up for being a jerk. Like, you know, I think that is something that we're actually obligated to defend. And in fact, something Reason has defended, I would argue, in our contretemps over the commenters' thoughts in our comment section on the judge in the Silk Road case, which Reason readers will remember wound up with us being subpoenaed and gagged.
Which, by the way, is not as fun as it sounds.
Yeah, it sounds delightful, but it wasn't that fun. The commenters were definitely being jerks, like implying that anyone should be put into a wood chipper is definitely kind of a dick move, but a fully legal dick move, not an actual threat. So I'm gonna stick up for fully legal dick moves here at the Reason Podcast.
On that note, we're seeing a situation where words are becoming weapons on a judicial level. There was a ruling this week, I think, over the weekend, of Michelle Carter of Massachusetts being convicted of involuntary manslaughter of her now deceased boyfriend, Conrad Roy III. Conrad Roy III had depression issues, and she, by text, encouraged him to kill himself. He went into his car. I think he did it by carbon monoxide poisoning, if I'm not mistaken. But even left the car at one point to check his messages, and she said, you know, get back in the car, that kind of thing. So she's now been convicted, and the law itself in Massachusetts doesn't have this on the books. There are certain states where you can be convicted of encouraging somebody to do something. Massachusetts isn't one of them. So there's a situation where both a law is being kind of created through a judge, but on a deeper level, that words themselves are weaponized in this case, and it has precedence to it. Now, Catherine, you send me text messages all the time saying that, you know, I should leave the country or I should just off myself and that kind of thing. But I don't think you're guilty of any particular legal problem. Do you think words are weapons in this judicial context?
Thanks for sticking up for me, Andrew. I appreciate it. And I in turn stand by all text messages that I've ever sent you. So
I'm making a coffee table clear. Book.
No, right. This is so Reason's own Robbie Suave wrote about this in The New York Times this weekend. The idea that words are violent is the thing we keep coming back to here. The idea that sending someone a text saying the time is right and you're ready, you just need to do it, is not the same thing as putting a gun to their head. It isn't. It's not the same thing. We make important, important distinctions between speech and action, and this is speech. The idea that in addition to criminalizing speech as violence here, this judge did it outside of the bounds of the law, which, you know, particularly in cases where some states have a law and some states don't, we can read intent into that. It's not like, oops, Massachusetts forgot to have a law criminalizing texting people and telling them to kill themselves. They don't have that law. So I think every piece of this case is troubling, but it's also consistent with, you know, not only the kind of background of the Scalise debate, but also the general tone of the debate on campuses about whether or not, you know, such as at Evergreen, whether or not quote unquote hateful speech is violence, whether or not discriminatory speech is violence. It's not. None of it's violence. It's an easy answer here. None of it's violence.
Nick, what do you think the root impulse is of this kind of, you know, on an academic level, now on a judicial level, to redefine words as violence? What's the internal push going on here on a thought level?
Yeah, that's I think it's a really good question, because it's definitely coming up in a lot of different circumstances. And I think it varies from place to place. And, you know, in politics, it's always about, you know, this is why we have campaign finance laws that seek to restrict the places and the amount of speech, the places that speech can take place, when it can take place, and how much of it can take place. It's to control, you know, if you control the discourse in politics, you have a better shot of getting your agenda through. I think on campuses, what we're seeing is a kind of coming of age. You know, we have been in the grip of the baby boom generation for 20 plus years, as the people who, at least since, you know, and you could peg it to different things, but certainly something like Bill Clinton winning the presidency in 1992 and becoming the first baby boomer president for, you know, the past 30 years, essentially, we've had boomers running all of the major institutions of power and influence and cultural significance. And that's ending. Millennials, there are more millennials just now, and they're getting into their 20s and 30s, and they're starting to run things. And there's, you know, there's always some kind of confrontation. And I think we're witnessing that. We saw that in the 60s and 70s as boomers started growing. I think in the courts, it's a bit different, but you do have similar impulses to restrict speech that particular people or particular power bases find questionable. What's interesting about today, and I think which is generally good and liberating, is that all of the attempts to try and quash speech in different ways and on different levels really fall flat because there are so many workarounds now, technological as well as cultural. I was just talking with somebody about Margaret Sanger, the birth control pioneer, and, you know, it was illegal during her time to send material about birth control, not even birth control, but just about contraception through the mail. We live in an age of free speech where we take it for granted. Books like Ulysses and Lady Chatterley Lover, Tropic of Cancer, weren't even fully legal in America to be printed in America until the early 1960s. This is amazing. It's unfathomable. And I think what we see now is just that it's never done. It's like, it's like America and Afghanistan or Iraq. We're never really going to be done with this battle. And we need to make sure that we contain the resistance to free speech as small and powerless and as scattered as possible. And that's where I worry when you see something like Evergreen State, when you see the rhetoric in response to the Scalise shooting or, this text case, like you start to worry that this freedom we take for granted is foundational to virtually everything else we can do is actually quite precarious.
When I look at these cases on an individual basis, I'm not as worried about them. If I Evergreen College, there's kind of the left is eating its own. In the case of Massachusetts, while I disagree with the judicial decision, it's an isolated incident. Matt, are these what's the scope of what could happen? What should people be worried about? And what happens if we keep going down a path of redefining what words and violence are?
My worry here is that. So on the First Amendment and free speech angle, the Supreme Court has been very vigorous in defense of it and widening the protections of it over the past 10 to 15 years in a series of decisions, including Citizens United, including flag burning stuff from 1989, 1990. We've had a good run. However, many people have observed, most notably Barry Friedman in his book from 2009, that the Supreme Court often follows where the culture has gone, follows where public opinion is going. And I think there's a growing sentiment within public opinion or a faction within it where the culture of free speech is backsliding, even as the practice of it is expanding for the most part. So that's what I worry about, is that the cultures that we see. And I mean, Evergreen State University, let's be real about it, is a pretty extreme college in every it makes Reed College in Oregon look kind of righty by comparison. The students run everything. They have a 98% acceptance rate from what I understand. And so it is going to be a weird place. But then again, watch that video. Oh my God. It's like seeing a show trial from Czechoslovakia in 1953, the way that the professors and the presidents of the school and even students are just sort of like talking about, the guy wouldn't even deny that he was a white supremacist, the president of the college. He's like, well, some people think so. So you can see if that's out there in the culture, yes, it's an extreme wing of the culture, but we see echoes of that elsewhere. What happens 10 years from now as, if that spreads, and will that affect things going forward? So that's my big worry about it. I would just like to inject a little bit of something into the involuntary manslaughter case, which is to say incitement as a Supreme Court question. It does exist. Incitement is when you go to someone and say, hey, I think you should pick up that brick and throw it through that window over there. Here, let's go together. That's when you're talking about incitement. If you are in the middle of a riot and say, let's go burn the mother down, that's not incitement. That's an important distinction there. And so in this specific case, when the guy's committing suicide, he's mid-suiciding. He gets out of the car. She knows this, presumably, and says, get back in the car. I think we're tiptoeing towards that kind of incitement model. And I don't know enough about the specific case or the case law of it. So in that, it seems to me that maybe it's not going to be a huge precedent creator. We're going to see more test cases cases like that, however, with all of this kind of social media bullying and whatnot out there. And that's where the case law is going to be created. I am worried about that. But typically, where you worry the most about all of these things are where it intersects with national security, because there the Supreme Court and others give a maximum amount of deference to the federal government or just to law enforcement in general. And we will see those fights play out, particularly in things like third party doctrine of whether the government has a right to look through all of your bank records and stuff that you share with third parties. And hopefully in that process, the Fourth Amendment will be restored to something like its original intent. But I don't have a lot of hope for that.
The Evergreen College video, too, I found striking because it's exactly like that video from Yale a couple years ago, where the students are all surrounding the professor. They're doing this kind of, yeah, I mean, it has a very like struggle session feel to it. And the phrase that keeps coming up is, you don't get to say that. It's not your turn to talk. You're not allowed to talk. And the clear belief and articulated belief on the part of students in that group, at least, if not all of them, that the professor's speech, which in both cases, in the Yale case and in the Evergreen case, is like a considered letter written in a temperate tone suggesting that perhaps a university policy is not conducive to the goals of the institution, that is violence against minority students. It's not violence. And the clearly fairly widespread belief, at least among these kind of campus radical types, that it is, that's where I start to get worried about Nick's kind of generational point of if people just sort of casually believe that speech that makes them upset is hate speech, and hate speech should be or is already illegal, because many of these students already believe hate speech is illegal, then we're creating a status quo that's or a kind of presumptive status quo that's bad news.
Well, it raises, pivot on that and go back to something Matt said. It's, you know, free speech and national security often in those showdowns, free speech often loses. Same thing with younger people. The younger you are, if you're saying something that might be misinterpreted or problematic for young children, but even for college students, there's a lot of wiggle room there. Or people will say, we're going to be balancing the right of free expression with the right not to be, have your life made more difficult by encountering things you disagree with. We need to, I think this is particularly true for libertarians because free speech and free assembly is so central to everything that proceeds from a liberal order. I mean, and we need to really start pushing back. And this also goes to something, I forget who was saying it, but sometimes I think of rhetoric or writing as either expressive or persuasive. And expressive writing is when I might say, I'm a rootin' tootin' libertarian, and I'm not trying to convince anybody, but here's what I believe, take it or leave it. Persuasive writing is when you're trying to actually get people to consider your opinion and come over to your side. And I think with free speech, we have entered a place where we need to always be expressing an absolute right in unfettered free expression. But we also need to be making the case for why that is a better world, a more moral world, a more fair world. Because I think a lot of the people who are in favor of harshly limiting speech, whether it's political speech or cultural speech or sexual speech, all sorts of things, they see short-term gains and losses, and that's all they care about. And we need to really kind of look at the principle of it and how it benefits everybody, even people who are momentarily discomforted by what they might be hearing or encountering at any point in time.
There's a disturbing amount of sort of consequence-oriented support of freedom of speech. I see this in political rhetoric coming out of our friends in Europe and the United Kingdom, where they'll say something like, well, freedom of speech is good because the end result of people interacting creates wonderful ideas. I think you're missing the point if you think that it's ultimately going to benefit a large group of people. It kind of starts on an individual rights level. It's a deontological phenomenon that does inadvertently affect, the greater country. But if we had to judge whether something was good or bad in terms of speech based on the outcome of it, we wouldn't have a lot of stuff going on. We're on an international level. We are going to be restricting some of the rights that we Americans have when we go to Cuba now, because Trump is pivoting on Obama's policy, which opened up Cuba to a large extent. President Obama removed travel restrictions so Americans could go. He allowed for a lot of technology in the agricultural sector to be transferred there. So there's been a lot of investment from agricultural companies and from travel coming into there. Trump hasn't completely reversed that, but he has made it. He has restricted those of us just as private citizens that might want to go there. We have to go with a tour group for some reason. He's using language which appears to be kind of endorsing sanctions. I'm assuming that you guys are against this, but if I'm not, Matt, you lived in Cuba for a while, didn't you?
I tried to. It didn't work out. I moved there with intent to habitate in January of 1998 and lasted a month or so. Before I realized what a dumb idea it was, and then visited as part of our reason in Cuba with Nick and Senator Jeff Flake and some others a year and change ago, which was a pretty remarkable experience to see how things had changed and stayed the same over that period of time. It's funny to watch the way that Trump portrayed this, the way that Marco Rubio, who was involved in this and was at the unveiling, which was at the Bay of Pigs theater, or a theater named after someone in the Bay of Pigs invasion in Little Havana in Miami. Heritage Foundation tweeted out like this, you know, Trump is completely overturned Obama's policy. He didn't come close to that. He kept almost most of what Obama changed in end of 2014, the beginning of 2015 remains with us. The prisoner exchange is the prisoner exchange. It happened already. Diplomatic relations with embassies in both capitals, we're keeping it. Most of the travel among Americans to Cuba, and most of, this is especially important, of the remittances that they send back home, the levels of which were quadrupled under Obama, most of that remains because it affects Cuban Americans. And Trump decided that it's okay, we'll allow Cuban Americans to continue visiting as much as they want. It's just the gringos who are going to have to, like they did before 2015, have to apply for a license with the Department of Treasury's aptly named Office of Foreign Assets Control to go to Cuba. So it's this weird thing in which the Cubans were yelling and screaming, largely because of Trump's rhetorical gestures towards talking about the awfulness of the regime in accurate to my ears tones that are much more strident than what Barack Obama did, because Obama's goal was to make his deal of easing the sanctions as much as he can. Remember, the sanctions were imposed by Congress in the 60s, and the president can't wave his magic wand to make them go away. He can do things in the margins. So what Trump did is wrong. His rhetoric about it is disastrously, stupidly wrong, in which he said that Americans traveling over there do not help the Cuban people. They only help the Cuban regime. That's just flat false, as Jeff Flake testified to us. Now, in Flake's estimation, 25% or so of the economy is outside of the control of the government, and a large part of that is because of interactions with tourists who are able to come there and do direct engagement with people through Airbnb and art and other kinds of stuff. So it's a bad move, yet it's not that significant. It just shows that the ideas behind it will not die and are still stupid. The idea that if we could just sanction the communism out of Cuba, it's as wrong now as it was in the 60s. And it's sad to see that happen. And hopefully it won't be that big of an impediment to things. Just the notion that restricting Americans' right to travel and to invest elsewhere is the ticket to changing some other country is nonsense and should be rejected out of hand.
So we imposed these sanctions in the 1960s. The Cuban communist regime has not been brought down. So presumably the sanctions have not done a whole lot to impact Castro and his successor. Catherine, do sanctions ever have an actual efficacy to them? Are they a good policy idea? Is this just a misappropriation of sanctions? What do you think?
Something I love when I was reading around the reactions to Trump's move. Places like National Review were saying, like, well, actually, if you take a look, you know, capitalism hasn't come to Cuba. Freedom hasn't come to Cuba since Obama lifted the sanctions, which just shows that that was the wrong approach and we should reverse it. Totally, apparently, deaf to the reverse of that argument. Like, okay, but also decades of sanctions didn't bring freedom to Cuba. So maybe we shouldn't have that particular argument if you're trying to argue pro-sanctions. I basically think that there are some very, very narrow circumstances in which sanctions work, and they are nearly always targeted and punitive on particular leaders or powerful people in a disfavored nation, right? So like freezing the bank accounts of known funders of terror, refusing to do official U.S. business with Russia's worst crony capitalists or oligarchs, that kind of thing, sure, by all means. A generally punitive shutting down of trade to an entire people or travel to an entire place doesn't work. And what's more, it feeds the paranoia and gives an argument to totalitarian or authoritarian leaders. We're seeing this in Venezuela, where they are absolutely blaming, where Maduro is saying to his people, it's the Americans. The Americans aren't trading with us, and that's why your baby doesn't have medicine. And some people will always believe that. The only way that people won't believe that is if Americans never, ever, ever refuse to send a baby's medicine in open trade, right? Like, it's plausible because we do it. And we shouldn't do it. It's morally wrong and ineffective. So, you know, I think in the Cuba case, it's manifest that the sanctions have not caused Cubans to rethink their commitment, such as it exists, to their variant of communism. And the window dressing of the current situation in which, okay, so you can't freely travel there. You can only travel there if you get the right series of papers in the right order with the right stamps on them. But that's totally not the same thing. And as Matt rightly points out, our continued engagement on a diplomatic level means that Trump did not, in fact, reverse Obama's policies in most cases.
When I look at this kind of situation, my sort of inner Ron Swanson starts yelling because I feel that as an American, I should be able to travel wherever I want without my government interfering on that. Nick, are there situations where that right should be curtailed because of some diplomatic situation going on where it's going to affect the greater good? Is that a right which can be restricted?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, libertarians aren't anarchists, but I think if we're in an openly declared war, there's many precedents and a lot of logic to say, you know, you can't go travel freely to Japan during World War II. Something like that. I mean, there are restrictions that are put in place, and as long as they're temporary and clearly limited, I don't think they're necessarily a problem. With Cuba, one of the things, and Catherine was getting at this, Cuba is free to trade with any country in the world except the United States. And all the embargo has done on for the Castro regimes has been to give them plausible deniability for why they are so poor. The way that most foreign investment in Cuba works, it's ironically, it's one of the last vestiges, not of communism, but of capitalism, as Marx said it was practiced in the 19th century, where essentially all public investment or all the workers actually get paid by the state, and the state takes a huge rake off of surplus value created by the Cuban workers at hotels and other places, and then gives a small fraction of that to the actual Cuban people. And they get to justify having crappy living standards because of the great state in America. More to the point, and I guess this is partly what both Matt and Catherine were getting at, you know, Cuba, there's limits to what we can do to make Cuba a better place. But the idea that a United States citizen would be banned from going to a country with that we're not at war with, and that there's really no good reason for why we can't go there as private citizens and do stuff, that should bother everybody. Sadly, Cuba is a very bizarre, idiosyncratic situation, and the politics of it are completely controlled by a small group of people who are on both sides of the issue that are in Florida. Jeff Flake, a congressman, now a senator from Arizona, it was odd, and he gets a lot of heat for simply talking about something that he shouldn't bother, he doesn't have any right to do. because he's not from Florida and doesn't have either ethnic solidarity with people from Cuba or a geographic proximity. But it's a shame, and it'll change. And these are the types of things where I think American voters, you know, the Castro regime has been changing, and it's going to get better. What Matt and I saw down there when we went on a recent trip is people are so ready to move on, and they will. The minute that they can, it will get much, much better very quickly. But the question of what the U.S. could be doing is if we could speed that up by 5 years, as opposed to, you know, making it take 5 years rather than 15 years by liberalizing our policy, that would save so many people's lives. It would make them so much better. And it's just a shame that these people are kind of stuck in history for no reason of their own other than a really rotten accident of birth.
A couple of add-on points quickly. One, Andrew, you asked about whether sanctions ever work. In the sanctions literature, which I haven't marinated it in a while, but I used to pay a lot of attention to it, the one classic exception to the rule was widely seen as sanctions against apartheid South Africa in the 1980s because everyone in the world did it and because it overlapped with changing the behavior of a regime, but that it's really difficult, generally speaking, to get everyone to participate and to do this in such a way that it has the intended effects. And generally speaking, it has the opposite. I mean, it's like 99% of the time it's a bad idea, or at least it's an ineffective idea in addition to being a bad idea. Another thing that was kind of lost in that Trump speech, as I was watching, which is pretty interesting, a lot of people, including Justin Amash, dinged Trump for being inconsistent in his approach towards championing freedom in the world, comparing his speech in Little Havana to his speech in Saudi Arabia, which we have talked about previously in this podcast, and which Nick has blogged about. In Saudi Arabia, Trump says, "We're not here to lecture other people on how to live." In Little Havana, Trump says, "We will be, we will call out the regime on its crimes, and we will be the champion of a free Cuba." Trump explicitly addressed that in his speech. He went back and he called back his Saudi Arabia speech, and he said in that speech, "I said that people around the world are going to have to take responsibility for their own affairs in their own regions." And then a couple of times in his speech, he talked about how America is going to be a champion of freedom in our hemisphere. And he also talked about Venezuela. So it was a very Monroe Doctrine-y type of approach out there. And I think it's going to have interesting potential knock-on effects or impacts, or at least be a window into the approach of the Trump administration when it comes to spheres of influence around Russia in particular and in other parts of the world. I think so. He's positing that we're not going to be freedom's champion if you have enough oceans between us and you. But if it's a place that's traditionally in our backyard, we're going to be all up in your business. And that's just interesting going forward.
Matt, is there a particular reason that Cuban Americans from Florida and elsewhere, like Marco Rubio and I think Representative Diaz-Balart, are so not just anti-communist regime, but so specific in the policies that they employ to go after the communist regime? Nick was talking about earlier how there's this political community in Florida that has tremendous sway. Why is it that the anti-communist Cubans always want to have a government crackdown as opposed to free markets?
I mean, I can understand where they're coming from. I mean, Glenn Garvin, who writes TV stuff for us and also does great work for the magazine, he's someone who I've seen in our presence defend the embargo with tears in his eyes, talking about all of the families who've been absolutely mangled by this murderous, evil dictatorship. You get emotional about this stuff. And I totally get that. I understand that. They're right to point out that a lot of the money that is spent in Cuba, particularly in joint ventures with the Cuban government and with the Cuban military, which is what Trump was talking about, goes to the government. That money, I mean, it's when I was there in 98, we tried so hard every day to spend money in such a way that it wouldn't end up in the government's hands. And it was really hard. If you wanted to do anything of heft or value, back then, if you wanted to get a cell phone, you had to give the government a check for $450 just to activate it. And you knew this was going to the Castro regime. It sucked. You wanted to not do that. You wanted to find the private individuals. So they have some truth in that. It's less true now because it's a lot easier to send both their remittances, which they do. I mean, part of the great irony in all of this is that the Cuban-American lobby, to the extent that it exists, and it does, usually has been against a lot of these liberalizing things that the Obama administration and the Clinton administration had done previously, and then immediately take advantage of all of them, right? Like, my God, don't lift the travel embargo. Oh, wait, I can go? Awesome. I think part of it is just sort of it's difficult for anybody, let alone someone who has families ripped apart, to sit back and take the long game argument of it's better to have overall engagements and overall prosperity. You want to take a club and beat the enemy with it. So I get it. I think they're wrong, and we have to engage in arguments to show that they're wrong. And there's some younger generation of Cuban-American politicians, including Carlos Cubuela, who have a somewhat different approaches to all this stuff. So hopefully with time and with engagement. I mean, Marco Rubio, from all press accounts, has never visited the island except for Guantanamo Bay. I wish you would. I think it changes your perspective once you talk to people on the ground.
Nick, before we move on to different topics, can you spell out the difference between socialism and communism?
I guess that's the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Okay. All right. So some blurs. So moving on, we've had a sort of sainted figure within nerddom pop back into the news, and that's Gary Gygax, who is the founder, I don't know, the originator of Dungeons and Dragons, which is near and dear to my heart. It's going to surprise you to learn that I played this when I was in high school. My friendship group, we'd play Dungeons and Dragons on Friday night. Then we'd drive around a lake with a spotlight and shine it at cars that were parked, and then they'd chase us and try and kill us. So it was a fun part of my adolescence, and I think is kind of getting steam now as everybody's really investing in nostalgia and in nerddom. The hook is that we've now have access to some of the FOIA documents that were coming out of the FBI. And it turns out that the FBI saw the creator of Dungeons and Dragons as a eccentric, frightening man who owned a weapon and was a member of the Libertarian Party and had all sorts of non-cooperative elements in his personality. So, Catherine, do we now beatify him as a saint of libertarianism or of nerddom? Where does he now fit in the pantheon?
I think Reason actually did that long ago when he died in 2008. We wrote a eulogy claiming that he saved more lives than penicillin due to the fact that a bunch of sad nerds were redeemed by him. I mean, honestly, maybe if the suicidal kid had just been like a, you know, a D&D player, it all could have come out differently for free speech. But these documents, which were obtained by Reason reporter C.J. Ciaramella, who just does FOIAs for fun. He just is like, oh, Freedom of Information Act request on FBI files on Dungeons and Dragons founder. Yeah, let's just do that. It's Saturday night. It's not unlike yourself, Heaton. Just the wording of it is particularly glorious. I just want to read for you. So he is described by a source, actually, to be fair. This is not in the omniscient voice of the FBI, but in the words of a source, that he is a drug user. He is known to carry a weapon and was proud of his record of personally answering any letter coming from a prison. Gygax set up a holding company in Liberia to avoid paying taxes. He is known to be a member of the Libertarian Party. And then it goes on to say, it is believed that Gygax would be extremely uncooperative if the FBI attempted to interview him regarding his knowledge of something, redacted. War gamers are very loyal to one another, and interviewees should be selected carefully so that the investigation is not jeopardized. So, as CJ summarizes it, Gary Gygax wasn't a snitch and fought the power. And I, for one, am willing to add him to the canon right now.
I'm curious as to what the FBI would have wanted his cooperation in, and what insights he would have based on his preeminence within the nerd community. I didn't know that was a group that the FBI was trying to crack.
So CJ actually did a follow up piece on this precisely to, I think, many people answered, had that same interest. And the FBI was, in fact, investigating a whole web of people around the wargaming community. It had to do with the cocaine trade. And it's the whole thing is just extremely 1980s, basically, although the raid on the relevant offices was in 1995, I believe.
So with Gary Gygax, I think he's emblematic of what happens periodically, whereas you get people in the libertarian movement and the Libertarian Party who are kind of rough around the edges and not mainstream thinkers, but as a result produce a lot of interesting out-of-the-box thinking like Dungeons and Dragons. Nick, do you see any other comparable figures that sort of had a downstream cultural effect? And do you think any small government ideas are championed in Dungeons and Dragons that might have proliferated through it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I love Gary Gygax as a concept simply because he's like, in a way, Japanese Nintendo game designer Shigeru Miyamoto, who is probably responsible for more gaming time than anybody on the planet. He was involved in the creation of The Legend of Zelda, as well as Mario Brothers, and essentially every major Nintendo franchise. And these are guys who you know very little about, but they just have a profound influence. Gygax, it's just fascinating. And when you look at TSR Games, the company that he co-founded and left, and role-playing games and card games from the, I guess going back to the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you throw in things like Stratomatic. They were just these odd, interesting, fascinating kind of cultural moments that allowed a lot of people to have a lot of fun and also to sharpen, you know, both planning and strategy and fantasy life. I did not know at first when Gary Gygax died, I didn't know that he had this libertarian connection, but it makes me feel a little bit better about being libertarian. One of the things that I think the FBI and law enforcement more generally were also involved in the 80s related to Dungeons and Dragons was it was the full flowering of not quite of a counterculture thing, there was the panics over satanic child abuse, about the idea of Satanism. I mean, Time and Newsweek used to have, you know, a couple of times a year in between running stories about whether or not the dinosaurs, ate the Atkins diet and the Virgin Mary was killed by an asteroid or something. They would have stories about how Satanism was alive and well and living in your kid's basement, et cetera. And that freaked people shit. One of the best books that anybody could find, and this is not to cast partisan fingers in any direction, but Tipper Gore's bestseller, Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated World, from the late 80s, early 90s, it has a whole chapter devoted to Dungeons and Dragons and about how it's a satanic game that the kids are playing that they can't win. And the level of seriousness with which kind of witchcraft and the occult and all of that kind of, just kind of free association mind play, the anxiety that stoked in people, including the highest levels of government, is really kind of fascinating. And it led directly into a kind of what at various points, and I guess it's, Bruce Sterling wrote a book in the early 90s called The Hacker Crackdown, when gaming kind of slid into computers, which were a relatively new and novel technology that were going mainstream, personal computers. It led to just all kinds of shit hitting the fan because it's something new. It's something novel. We see it again and again whenever anything new comes out. But there's a lot of teachable moments there.
Are there any other people that are around today that are, from a libertarian background, a libertarian mindset, that are having effects on culture that are rippling out? I mean, is South Park or someone within the nerd sphere that you can point to that has a classical liberal reach?
You know, Heaton, I don't know why you're asking me about the nerd sphere, because I'm an extremely cool person who doesn't know about that.
Super cool KMG. That's what we call you.
Yeah. No, as someone who recently took up Dungeons and Dragons, the ability to stand on non-nerd ground is very weak here. I think there are a few other people who are changing the culture in ways that will make the world more libertarian. I think that they are not as sort of obviously cultural as Gygax. I mean, I'm thinking here of Jeff Bezos. I'm thinking here of Elon Musk. I'm thinking of people who just have changed our expectations around what kind of stuff we can get, how fast we can get it. The idea that we can get whatever we want all the time is a super powerful idea that has revolutionized the culture. It's not the same as being like, hey, everybody, let's get together, roll dice, and imagine that we're mystical creatures who are definitely not hobbits due to copyright and intellectual property reasons. That I think is a little untouched. I would argue that there are cultural forces pushing against some of the kind of libertarian tendencies, including maybe the rise of the superhero movie and associated culture, in which there seems to be always, even if corrupt, a powerful and well-coordinated state behind a bunch of superhuman beings who have control of everything. So just don't worry about it, you mere mortal.
Well, before we sign off, I think America wants to know, Catherine, who is your character in Dungeons & Dragons?
I have promised to my Reason colleagues with whom I play that everything about our gaming sessions is off the record, and I would never violate that sacred trust.
Well, I speak for everyone in saying I can't wait for the FOIA request of the FBI to reveal your character and what nefarious activities you and our colleagues have been up to. Any closing thoughts, Nick?
No. Other than I will point out, as Catherine mentioned, Amazon and Jeff Bezos changing the culture over the last couple of days. Amazon made purchased Whole Foods, and in there you see Whole Foods run by John Mackey, or co-created by John Mackey, who's a libertarian. Both Bezos and Mackey have been benefactors of Reason, but there you see the type of soft power of libertarian thinking, of that idea of allowing people greater and greater choice, or more and more specific goods that value and that express the values of the customers, as well as, you know, supply whatever basic needs they need met. And this is the thing about, I think, American culture and its libertarianness, is that it does not present itself as a emanating from an ideological or dogmatic leader of a business. These guys have definite attitudes, and it infuses what they do and how they do it and what they say. But it's really about delivering the goods in terms of expanding people's ability to express themselves and to define themselves and to get the stuff that they want, that then they use to build into their own best version of themselves. And that's, that is not a small thing. And to the extent that we recognize that as a good thing, and we recognize it as a libertarian thing, I think it furthers the mission of Reason to say it's going to be a better world, a fairer world, a more innovative world, a more interesting world, if people are left to their own devices to create whatever they want more and more.
Well said, and emblematic of free minds and free markets. You've been listening to the Reason Podcast, your digital pipeline to sex, drugs, robots, and Dungeons and Dragons, in addition to politics and everything else. Joined today by Nick. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Matt Welch.
Thanks.
And fourth level mage, Catherine Megaward.
Someday.
All right. Thanks, guys.